afternoon watch, and this is your Captain Joe. Your Captain Joe up in a captain's chair, but not the captain's chair, because I am not in the Gene Bosch broadcast studio on the magical Isle of Vashon. I am at the Bell Harbor Conference Center for a meeting on harbor safety. My greetings today go out to all of Captain Joe's people all over the world who missed the broadcast last week. We had a little technical problem, and the only part of it that got saved to the archive was the first 6.5 minutes, and that missed all of the golden words that came after that. So some of that I will recreate today, the book and the magazine, for example, but some of it is going to be new material, and I am going to move now because we only have half an hour together, and I have a couple of sad things to talk about in the binnacle list. Before I get to the sad part, however, there are two removals from the binnacle list. I had a signal today from my friend and shipmate, my Vietnam shipmate, Josh, who is pleading with his captain to be removed from the binnacle list because the conditions about which he is and for which he is being treated are in such good shape that he feels that occupying a place on the binnacle list is taking up space that is needed by somebody else. I replied to that by saying that the binnacle list has an infinite size, as your captain's heart. And therefore, should the time come when it is time for him to go back on the binnacle list, he shall find a place there. The other removal is Captain O'Brien, who is engineering for me today, and on whom all blessings flow for that and for his lovely friendship over the years, over the more than 20 years that we have worked together, done so many good things together, and I just have the highest regard and respect for him. And he is now almost fully recovered from the pro tem malady that put him on the binnacle list in the first place. The sad parts are that there are three. The first one is the wife of one of my closest island friends, and Marlis was also a dear and good friend. Bob was a Navy veteran of Korea, and he also served on my board for the Point Robinson Lighthouse. And his wife, Marlis, was a frequent and much-loved contributor to all of the activities that we did together. They're both of them gone now, and they're probably possibly will be together out in Tahoma National Cemetery. The second one is my friend and Army Ranger friend, General Joe. He died just a few days ago. He moved off the island into an assisted living facility, and when he left, we had planned for him to, once he got settled down with Rusty, his dog, that he would have his bugler sound assembly, and all of his mates would get together and gather around him. But I, alas, was never to see him alive again. He had a remarkable career. He went into the Army when I believe he was not quite of age. I think that he fudged maybe, and he got his parents to fudge a little bit on that. He enlisted, and he worked his way all the way up through to become a brigadier general. He served in World War II, he served in Korea, and he served in Vietnam. At my 90th birthday, he was in a wheelchair, but he was still fully capable and was ready to be a full participant in the festivities. And he made some very fulsome and very generous remarks. He and I had just a great relationship. And one of his jobs was the assistant military attaché to our embassy in Moscow, and he and his late wife Edie would go out with surreptitious cameras and take photographs. Not only was he an interesting gentleman, but he was indeed just that. He was a gentleman. He was over 90, 92, 93. But I consider those ages to be contemporaneous. And so I was hopeful that we would all have some more years together. But it was not to be. And so I hope that the Army will accord him a proper funeral for a general officer. That would be his last gift to the island. And I am standing by for the funeral arrangement. The third one is one which is not connected to us directly, but it is as a result of a training accident, and that is that the commanding officer of SEAL Team 8 died in a training accident. And I bring that up here not just because he is a brother in arms, or he was a brother in arms, but because we need to be reminded that proper and complete training for the rigors that are going to come after that involve risks of their own. And this gentleman understood that. I don't know exactly the details of his death, but whatever those details are, I am confident that his family is incredibly proud of him, as am I. As my own situation continues, steady as she goes, I am still carrying around with me, just in case the hour of need may happen, the necessary equipment and skills to do a Foley insertion, but so far, so good. And the order to the helmsman is not only steady as she goes, but keep her so. All of you quartermasters out there know the significance of those two commands. Meet her, steady as she goes, and keep her so. My book last week, and is again this week, is called Frozen in Time. It is by an author by the name of Mitchell Zukov, and it came to me at the same time that the news of the death of one of our rescue swimmers happened, and the story, Frozen in Time, is the story of the search for the wreckage of a Coast Guard amphibious aircraft that went down searching for a B-17 crew in Greenland during World War II. And the aircraft, the Coast Guard aircraft, and the bodies of the two crew members, plus an Air Force crew member or an Army Air Force crew member, have never been located. And so this is the story of that particular search. And it ends with no success yet. Now, I do not yet know whether subsequent events after the finish of this book, they have found the wreckage of that aircraft and they found the bodies of the people that were in it. But it opens with a statement that is very well known to all Coast Guard people who are in the rescue business, and that is that one of the first things that I heard when I started learning Coast Guard history at the Coast Guard Academy was you have to go out, but you don't have to come back. And then we spent 4 years learning how to come back. And I took that teaching very seriously. I established and maintained as part of my service reputation that if you went out with Captain Joe, that you were going to come home. You may be a little battered, you may be a little bent, depending on the mission and the weather or other circumstances, but you were going to come home, and you were also going to come home with those that you were sent out to rescue. This ties in with the death of this young rescue swimmer. And these accidents are tragic because, in this particular case, this young man, apparently he fell. And again, I don't know the details of the accident yet, but he went out and he did not come back. So there is not only a grieving family, but a grieving fiance, because he was just about ready to propose a contract of marriage with his fiance. And now, of course, that will not happen. So the book is Frozen in Time by Mitchell Zukov. It is a story of survival and of not surviving. And it is connected to the death of this young Coast Guard rescue swimmer. And so in your reading and in your thinking, tie them all together, because every day today, Coast Guardsmen go out. They have every intent of coming back, but every now and then something happens and they don't make it home. The magazine this week is the Professional Mariner. And the issue in which I am particularly interested this week is one from last month, and it has an article about the Great Lakes pilots. And this is of interest to me because these are the pilots who pilot saltwater ships through the St. Mary's River system, and that was the part of the world that I was the commander of. The St. Mary's River, and of course I had my much-loved Coast Guard cutter Northwind in the lakes for the year before I became the commander, and I could have written a pilot's exam myself for the stretch of water from Whitefish Bay through the locks, down through the rock cut, and down through the St. Mary's River, and all the way to the great and thriving metropolis of St. Ignace. I was then became the captain of the fort and the commander of all Coast Guard people and units in that part of the world. One of the, if I had to have a shore job, that was the one that I loved the most out of all the shore jobs that I had to endure. That one followed closely by when I was the ice boss for that great gentleman of our service, Commandant Admiral Jim Gracie. A couple of things to get caught up on this particular meeting that I'm attending today in the afternoon session. They're going to be a panel discussion about shipboard firefighting, and I am really looking forward to that because I hope that one of the case studies that they're going to bring out is the fire in San Diego in Bonhomme Richard. You all will recall that I have discussed that one at some length because that fire was completely preventable, and it happened because of incredibly poor shipboard housekeeping. The other part of it that caused her captain properly to be relieved was that he was not aboard his ship when she was at one of her highest risks and had not personally inspected the places where work was going on. And you can say, well, Captain is not expected to go to all of the compartments in all of the ships. And I'm saying, yes, I do expect that. I had been in every compartment in my Northwind. There were over 400 of them. I've been in every one of the compartments that was accessible, and that included the fuel tank. And I've been underneath her when she was up in the shipyard. And so, yes, I do expect the commanding officer to personally inspect places where shipyard work, especially burning, is going on. And that extends all the way to carriers, including Gerald R. Ford. Gerald R. Ford now has had a fire in her laundry, and this fire spread to berth decks, and she is now in a Greek shipyard being repaired. And how this got started, of course, we add this to the list of investigations that I am waiting to read and to hear and to report to you about as to how this fire got started. But along with her fire that she had with which got into a berth deck, and apparently there was something like 600 sailors that had to flake out on the deck. Well, I expect sailors to be able to do that without too much whining, mewing, and puking, and especially when the ship for which they're responsible and accountable has had something as serious as a fire. So they're not getting much sympathy from me about that, that they have to flake out on the deck while the repairs go forward so they can get back into their berth deck. The other thing, though, is that she has been plagued with troubles ever since she's been commissioned. And she has, for example, her sanitary system is not a gravity system. It's a vacuum system. And they have something like... if I'm reading the number correctly, something like 650 toilets in the ship, and all of them are have some sort of a vacuum flushing system that then transports all of the effluvia down into the holding tanks until she can get alongside and pump the holding tanks out. And so parenthetical insertion here, the holding tank in my much-loved Northwind was called Rosie. Rosie was a retrofit, of course, when Northwind was built. All of that sort of material was just pumped over the side. And so Rosie was a retrofit, and no matter how carefully Rosie had been installed, she still cast amongst her crew certain unpleasant odors, and that's why she was called Rosie. So the vacuum flush system, probably overcomplicated, probably a gravity system would have worked just as well, could have been made to work just as well, or a gravity system with pumps, with macerators and pumps. Another parenthetical insertion here, my 95-footer had what is called a macerator. The solids would go into this little tank. Then the when it was flushed, you could hear this thing whir, and there were knives inside the tank that flushed everything up and pumped it into the holding tank. So something like that, a much simpler system, could have been put into Gerald R. Ford. So, and she also has an incredibly complicated catapult system, and she has a much more complicated system for getting the arresting wires up and down. In other words, the engineers once again have prevailed and have made the ship much more complicated than she probably has to be. She's not now on the line. She is being repaired. And she's being repaired in Suda Bay, which is a U.S. Navy support facility. And I hope that she's back on the line soon. But I would imagine that with the complexities and with all of the CASREPs that she's now riding, I count at least three, that it's going to be a while before she is going to be ready and available, that she's going to be CAS Corps and can go back on the line. I don't remember whether I said anything about the underway replenishment collision between Truxton and the USNS Supply, but I've done some reading about the situation, the report that's come out so far, and I've also looked at the film clip a couple of times. Now, I do all of this with some degree of scanty knowledge about underway replenishments. I've done about 60 of them in Vietnam alongside oilers, ammunition ships, supply ships. And in those days, the ships were not manned by civilian crews of the Military Sealift Command. They were manned by naval captains who were in training to be carrier captains. And so I watched the approach as Truxton made her approach, and as soon as she got to the high pressure point back on the port quarter of the oiler, I knew right away that her conning officer was headed for trouble because he had the bow headed right towards that quarter section, and as soon as she punched through that high pressure area, she was going to collide, and sure enough, that's exactly what happened. I believe that her captain was in his first command. He'd been XO in the ship before, but my guess is that this was either her first unrep or pretty doggone close to it. And the place to learn how to do this is not when you are on the gun line. To get ready for Vietnam, we took my much-loved Ingham to Guantanamo Bay with the free training group Gitmo. And that was a month, and we had to add on a week because we didn't pass the first time around for the main battle problem. And in order to get the clean sweep room, we had to stay for another week and do some more intensive training. During that 5-week training period, though, we did a couple of unreps where we had trainers who walked everybody through, and including me as the conning officer, to learn about such things, such subtleties as that high pressure point that there is back on the quarter, and how you get yourself through that, and how you get yourself locked in alongside, and how you work yourself so that you are working at about 70 feet. That was my preferred distance, about between 70 and 80 feet, which is pretty close by Navy standards today. But then Navy standards for ship handling today, as are they for the Coast Guard, are extremely low. So what has happened with the with this particular case? Her captain's been relieved. Another captain has been assigned to her. And I don't know where they now go for intensive training before they actually do it for real. But UNREP is no place to be doing it on... to be doing it for real for the first time. An interesting thing here, you all know that there is a Wubbles Glacier. You all know that there is a Wubbles Room in the Shackleton Memorial Library of the Scott Fuller Research Institute. And now you're going to know that there is a Wubbles Hotel in Germany. The Ferienhof Wubbles. It's in the city of Rieste in Lower Saxony, and it is due east of Amsterdam. Now, I am going to send a signal to these people, and I'm going to tell them that they have a brother or uncle or something, a relative, because everybody named Wubbold with an umlaut over the U has got to be connected and related in some way. Now, my ancestors came to the United States in 1870, and we even know the name of the ship. I believe it was the SS Emma. I believe that was her name. And we know that his name was, I believe, Leo. And he came from the city of Oldenburg. So I'm going to send a signal to these people and let them know that not only are we related, but that it is my intent to come and stay in the Ferienhof Wubbold in Rieste in Lower Saxony. The interesting thing about Greenland for me is that the Coast Guard has been connected with Greenland for well over 100 years. And I, much loved Northwind, was involved with the Greenland Home Rule Government. And I think I've told that story on here about moving the muskox around in Northwind. And that was done at the behest of the Greenland government. I think it would be appropriate for me to send a signal to the current administration and remind them that we had the friendliest of relations with the people of Greenland, I've had these relations for over 100 years, and that this is neither the time nor the place to destroy that, so that we can continue to be able to share in the benefits of our relationship with the lovely people that inhabit that island, which, of course, is not green. It is almost all of it white. The people of the organization of this particular meeting are just now ringing a bell to remind all of us that it is time to go back into the meeting room, and I am going to do that. But I am, as always, and in particular today, because I have such news to report and to refresh my own recollection about, as always, all of you are in the palm of my hand. I continue to be a part, a contributor to all of these groups and meetings that I attend. And I am, my creative juices are flowing this very minute as we all scream into the meeting room. So this is, as always, and frequently, and with all the love and respect and admiration that I can muster, which is consider, this is your Captain Joe. I am on station and watching properly.